Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, hour number two. This is David Inge, the host for the show. Glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about politics in Turkey today. In recent years, Turkey has experienced some significant economic growth. The big news, perhaps, was back in 1999 when the country formally applied for membership in the European Union. Membership talks were formally opened a year ago, about that October of 2005. Altogether, this process is expected to take about 10 years, and it has been, to say the very least, controversial, both in Europe, where there are some people who oppose Turkey's entry into the EU, and perhaps also in Turkey, where people are reacting to the European opposition. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about Turkey and its unique position in between Europe and Asia. And our guest for the program is Biral Yeşilada. He is professor of political science and international studies at Portland State University, where he also has the chair in contemporary Turkish studies and has been following politics in Turkey for quite a long time. Questions and comments are welcome as we move through this hour of the program. Anyone who's involved who would like to be involved can certainly do that by giving us a call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the number for local folks. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good for anyone who can hear us. If you're around Illinois or Indiana, or even if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Yeşilada, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Good. Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
I thought perhaps we might talk a little bit at the beginning about Turkey's entrance into the EU, mm-hmm. and about what sort of examining the perspectives a little bit from all of the various sides, but starting with the side of Turkey, mm-hmm. Because this is something, in fact, that Turkey has been interested in for a long time, even before there was an EU establishing that kind of connection. Perhaps as a basic kind of question, I'd ask you to talk a little bit about what Turkey stands to gain, perhaps both economically and politically, mm-hmm. from membership in the EU.
Well, it goes way back. This is being part of the Western family of nation states goes back to the Atatürk's revolution, 1920s, establishing the republic, and ever since that time, joining all the European organizations. Turkey has been a member of the Council of Europe, so it is in the family of European states. The European style development or modernization, if you may call that, precedes the Republic, Ottoman Empire, and reforms of the 19th century. And for centuries, the Ottoman Empire was basically a member of the European balance of power system. And in its last days, decline, it was, if you remember, referred to as the segment of Europe, not of the Orient. So in terms of the political elite, business elite, it has always been part of the European politics and economic sphere. The relations with the European Union goes back to 1961-63, when the Ankara Agreement was signed, establishing association membership for Turkey with the then European Economic Community. And relations have been progressing steadily. European markets are the number one markets for Turkish exports, and most of Turkey's imports do come from European markets. In terms of investments, a lot of European companies in Turkey, educational exchanges, the list goes on and on and on. Turkey applied for full membership in the EC in 87. And was politely told it's not time yet and that EU will not take a look at it. And as you mentioned earlier, in 1999, wanted to be included. But before that, there was a sort of a train wreck when at the Luxembourg summit '97, the European Union member states identified which Central and Eastern European countries will be invited to become candidates and eventually members of the EU and excluded Turkey. Well, the hell broke loose in that case, and we had 2 years of very intense diplomatic negotiations and trafficking by the United States, basically pointing out to everybody that this is not a good thing. At the Helsinki summit then, 99, Turkey was identified as a candidate, potential candidate. And last year, after many struggles of having to meet a number of political requirements of the Copenhagen criteria for membership, and maneuvering around some of the political problems pertaining to Cyprus, European Union open accession talks with Turkey. And as we speak right now, there is diplomatic traffic in Finland. Finland holds the EU presidency and has invited leaders, representatives of the Greek and Turkish Cypriot communities to Finland to talk about jump-starting the talks again. Because there is a potential danger of another train wreck with Turkey come December if Turkey does not open its ports and airports to Greek Cypriot ships and airplanes. And Turkey is resisting that by saying the European Union promised to lift the economic isolation of Turkish Cypriots after the referendum, and it hasn't done so thus far. So we will not move until EU delivers its promise. Catch 22.
We could talk. I want to make sure that we talk a little bit more about Cyprus because that seems to be one of the big stumbling blocks. Mm-hmm. But before that, it seems that if you look at public opinion in Europe on the issue of the inclusion of Turkey in the EU, there it's complicated, and there might be some number of reasons that people would voice for feeling that Turkey should not be admitted. But one that perhaps is the most problematic because it's the hardest to deal with is this perception that some Europeans voice that Turkey is not European. Now, it could be that people in Turkey feel this identification and feel that in a sense they are a European country, but apparently a lot of people in Europe feel otherwise. How do people in Turkey, how have people reacted to hearing that kind of comment come back to them from Europeans, and has that done anything to erode support within Turkey for its entry into the EU?
Mm-hmm. Well, public opinion in Turkey has gone downhill in terms of pro-EU sentiments. Used to be really high. About 3 years ago, was very high. And right now, majority of the people do not trust the European Union. And as for the public opinion in Europe versus public opinion in Turkey, I think it's mutual. I do not believe that when you ask most of the Turks that they will first identify themselves as European. They would identify themselves as Turks, and then perhaps European. And even there, I would be cautious about where this survey result is coming from. It's a very complex country with different cultures and identities throughout, and Turks are in search of their identity again. There's a lot of discussion about this in terms of where do we belong. And increasing number of people are showing a basic sentiment that, well, we can stand on our own 2 feet. We're a large country, powerful country, a lot of economic resources, and we could have good relations with our neighbors, including the EU, without being a member of the European Union. On the other hand, those who are the elites, basically, of the Western-oriented businesses, political parties, and even the military, they view membership in the European Union as anchoring once and for all Turkey's European belonging and fending off challenges from reactionary forces who are A, anti-reformist and ultranationalist, and B, Islamic fundamentalist. Turkey is going through this upheaval for the last 20-25 years of challenges from within. In Europe, I don't think most of the people are quite aware of what's going on in Turkey. I do travel over there quite a bit because of my research on the EU. And, you know, the Cold War's over. And during the Cold War, very few people questioned Turkey's belonging in the Western family of nations. It was a frontline state. And now that the Soviet threat is no longer there, Turkey is viewed as belonging to somewhere else. Now, that pretty much results in an anti-European sentiment in Turkey as well. I should also highlight one other thing. One development in Turkey that very much concerns me is the post-Iraq war fear of conspiracy theories, just rampant conspiracy theories that somehow everybody is ganging up against Turkey. And it's getting worse. If you take a look at the Turkish media that's feeding this fear constantly. And I have to also acknowledge that some of the European media sources and government officials or whatnot who have interest in distancing Turkey from the European Union have brought up certain issues such as Kurdish independence and not just Kurdish independence in northern Iraq, but talking about southeastern provinces of Turkey and eastern Turkey belonging in a future independent Kurdistan. When these things start hitting the press in Turkey, your average citizen reacts very negatively. And a lot of it is really unfounded, but they are nonetheless conspiracies and fears of conspiracy theories. So this is a very complex relationship that I think is leading in the direction of a lose-lose scenario rather than a win-win scenario, which must be addressed fairly quickly and brought back on track of mutual interests of Turkey and EU, and to move forward together. Turkey needs EU as much as EU needs Turkey. Based on the research that I'm looking at, my own research, comparing it with U.S. government research and World Bank research on future global power transition, economic growth, and competitiveness of various states. We are all talking about China as the emerging giant. Yes, it is. It's going to have parity with the United States in 2025, 2030, and then take over. Well, the EU scenario is pretty dark. EU's economic competitiveness is declining, and it will continue to decline. Per capita productivity in EU countries will remain just about constant, but the share of the combined EU economies in the world economy will fall to the fourth-ranking economy behind China, India, and United States. The recent enlargement of the European Union is not helping this because they've added rather small economies and very problematic economies, with the exception of Poland, and Poland has its own problems. It is not until EU brings in large dynamic economies like Turkey and Ukraine, particularly Turkey, that the tide turns around and the EU economy starts showing steady improvement. So when we look at the future scenarios, these are all probabilistic, of course, assuming that we don't have a catastrophic war that will delay everything by 10, 15, whatever years. It's really in the interest of both EU and Turkey to have this economic integration proceed.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we have a caller who's been waiting, and so we'd like to bring them into the conversation. We're talking this morning with Biral Yeshilada. He's professor of political science and international studies at Portland State University, where he holds the chair in contemporary Turkish studies. He's also director of the Northwest American Turkish Research Institute that's based there at Portland State, and is associate member of the board of directors of the Institute of Turkish Studies at Georgetown. Among his interests, the subject here we're talking about contemporary politics in Turkey, and also the issue of the enlargement past and future of the EU and what that means for global politics. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Champaign to bring in on our line one. Let's do that. Hello.
Yes, good afternoon. Yes. I'd like to welcome Professor to the program. And I want to ask, my name is Kostas, and I've lived in Greece. I was raised
yes.
in Greece. I'm a citizen of the European Union and a citizen of the United States. And I know that the European Union is not only about economics. It's also about respect for human rights. And what I'm getting at is in Turkey, you have a very strong military that doesn't hesitate to intervene you know, with democratic institutions such as, you know, a democratically elected government. It happened in 97 when they asked the prime minister to resign, I think, and he did. And so that military, that power of the military, you know, part of why the public opinion in Europe is negative is because, you know, the military is too powerful. You know, we have a European Union member that is still under occupation by Turkey's military. There's 30,000 Turkish troops stationed in Cyprus. You know, there's a military that whenever somebody mentions the Armenian genocide, you know, everybody in Turkey goes amok. There was a, you know, law, not a law, but a bill that passed right the lower house in France, I believe, recognizing the Armenian genocide and making it illegal for anybody to deny it, just like it's illegal to deny the Holocaust. So I would like to address the military, the role of the military, how it affects, you know, democracy in a negative way in Turkey, and also talk about the Armenian genocide. I also want to congratulate him on Orhan Pamuk winning the Nobel Prize in Literature, and he has recognized the genocide. He said that 1 million Armenians have perished in the early 19th century. So, yeah, those are a couple issues that I have. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. The caller has now given us enough to talk about for the next, I don't know how long.
Let me tackle them at least one by one. The role of the military in Turkey, that's a basic issue of civil-military relations in democracies. And in the European Union, in fact, the forthcoming EU report on Turkey, because EU Commission publishes reports on all the candidates in terms of their progress towards membership. And this is one of the issues, because the Turkish military in the last 3 months has again made very strong statements regarding A, Turkey's interest in the region, and B, Islamic reactionary forces in the country. One thing that we have to remember is that the role of the military in Turkey has changed. It has changed substantially, and that has changed through the last reform package of the Constitution, where the National Security Council was made to be an advisory body rather than a policy diktat for the government. The National Security Council is headed by the president of the country. It's chaired, rather, by the president of the country and has members from the government as well as the armed forces. The first example of where this played itself out was during the pre-referendum negotiate in Cyprus, which I was involved as an advisor from, not from the Turkish side, but from here, from the United States, and working with the Commission experts on the issue. The National Security Council met and voted in majority vote to hold a strong position, not one that looked conciliatory or one that would take a compromise position on Cyprus. The Prime Minister, Erdogan, thanked the National Security Council, went back to work, and proceeded to do whatever he wanted to do. And there was no reaction from the military. That was a first. I'm highlighting it because the 1982 Constitution of Turkey that was drafted under the auspices of the coup makers, the generals, had erased the liberal constitution of the country of 1961 and replaced it with a very authoritarian, state-dominated constitution that severely limited individual civil and political rights in the country. Turkish civilian politicians have been trying to civil society organizations have been trying to change that constitution since the end of the coup in 1983. I firmly believe that had it not been for EU membership aspirations, that we would still be looking at a Turkey that is very much a state authoritarian country, similar to the authoritarian countries of Latin America. But the reform process took hold, first in 1995, when Turkey and the EU negotiated the customs union, and then for the candidacy, 9 reform packages carried through, laws changed wholesale, and now the EU, and they will acknowledge this, is observing the speed of implementation of these reforms. And I have to point out that they're fairly slow and conflictual. In order to carry out the reforms and implement them, you also need to educate the judiciary, the police force, the teachers, everybody. And that takes time. This is why the Europeans are saying the earliest time for Turkey to join the European Union would be like 15 years. Mm-hmm. There are 2 reasons for that. One is the implementation of the reforms, which takes a long time. This is not a small country. We're talking about 70 million people. Günter Verhugen, former commissioner for enlargement, once told me that admitting Turkey is not even comparable to the recent Eastern enlargement of the European Union. It's like bringing in a continent. It's that big and complicated. And the second is budgetary issues of the EU. They want to make sure that Turkey is not viewed or brought in, rather, until the very next budget of the European Union is spent. So it creates a fundamental problems in the in the budget of the European Union. That's just a side note. In terms of human rights in the country, there have been improvements. There have been much improvements compared to when I was doing research in the country in the 80s, when I compared the 2 eras. There is still one particular law that gives the state prosecutor the opportunity to file complaints against a person for insulting the state or criticizing this or that or insulting the identity of Turkish people. In many European countries, this is viewed as a law that belongs in the dinosaur age. I'm not sure we can sell it in Turkey, because in Turkey we still have very much a political culture that has a strong identity with the state. Okay, so we have to be careful about the process of Europeanization in Turkey. That's just not going to happen overnight. With regard to military having any say over politics, the military in Turkey has a particular role in defending the constitution. That's true of many countries, including European countries. And one of the biggest threats in Turkey is a very insidious Islamic fundamentalism. When you have political forces that use the democratic process to advance a hidden agenda, and you do not have political parties that are powerful enough to stand in its way or change the tide, then the military gets very nervous. And this is why the Turkish military is once again identifying the Islamic fundamentalism as a fundamental threat to the laicist order of the Turkish state. Let me explain that very quickly, because I'm taking too long, but the issues raised are rather important. Mm-hmm. The Turkish political system is not secular. We translate it into English as a secular order, but it's really the French laic order. Laicism has the state dominating religious affairs. This is unlike what we have, separation of church and state and non-interference in each other's affairs. The model was chosen by Atatürk for a particular reason. He viewed no other way of controlling the reactionary Islamic opposition to the modern republic he was trying to build. Now, laicism has been criticized as a very harsh system by those who wanted to have a secular order, separation of church and state, and non-interference in each other's affairs. I don't think Turkey is there yet. Turkey has still the growing pains of trying to establish democratic consolidation. And we have to acknowledge one thing. Since 1950s, Islamic reactionary movement in Turkey has been growing very quietly. Very intelligently designed strategies have been put to work, and with a lot of money from overseas. And recently, there have been many cases that ended up in the European Court of Human Rights addressing the issue of headscarf. And it was turned back by the on the note that Turkey is a laicist order, and wearing the headscarf in public offices is viewed as a not just a personal dress code of an individual, but a ideological image, because it has been turned into a political issue. So this is not an easy thing to deal with. Look at France. France dealt with the issue of headscarf very quickly and discovered that, oh my God, we have a laicist system and this is not acceptable. And the case was closed. I don't think it's really over, because it's going to create future headaches for France as well. So you have this clash of both cultures and the political order of the country, which is laicist. If a political party or political groups are not system-oriented, meaning educating their followers to system orientation, then they become potential threats to the state. So this is one thing I wanted to highlight. When it comes to Cyprus, Turkish military is there. Absolutely. Turkish military is there according to the treaties of 1959 and 1960. We should not forget the fact that 1963 and 64 is when the crisis started on the island. And the basic problem I identify over there in Cyprus between the Greeks and Turks is that Turkish Cypriots will not forget how they were treated between 63 and 74, and Greek Cypriots will not forget what happened to them in 1974 when the Turkish military arrived. Now, everybody wants the Turkish military to leave. That is the position of the United Nations, the United States, and the European Union. That is why the Annan Plan was drafted. Unfortunately, that plan did not pass. Had it passed, 43,000 Turkish troops would have left the island in a time frame that would have started the very next day with withdrawal of 10,000 troops. That's what we're working on, trying to jumpstart these negotiations again and to create a Cyprus that is based on the basic memorandum of understanding that were signed between the Turkish Cypriot and Greek Cypriot leaders in the late 70s, and the principles of this memorandum entered into the UN Security Council resolutions that say future of Cyprus will be a bi-zonal, bi-communal federation. 95% of it is resolved. Both sides agree upon it. It is the nature of the federal order that they cannot agree upon. That's what we're working on. And I'm still cautiously optimistic as someone who worked on the plan and and tried very hard to get the Cypriots to vote yes for the peace plan. We had a setback, but I think we're going to get there. Now, what was the last one? Armenian genocide issue. A lot of people are discussing it in Turkey. They're just not calling it genocide. And they get very angry when it is imposed upon them to single-handedly recognize it as a genocide. I'm not a historian, but I have talked to many Ottoman historians about this and Armenian historians about it. And I don't think it's going to be resolved through a political decision. The historians have to get the facts in front of everybody. Nobody can deny, and those who do deny, that Armenians are not killed in the Ottoman Empire should have their heads examined. And the nature of the expulsion sort of resembles to me, from my point of view, is like the Trail of Tears when the Cherokee were moved from one part of the United States to the other, and so many perished along the way. The ultra-nationalist Turks will absolutely deny that, that there were systematic killings along the way. There were. In terms of how many people died, hundreds of thousands, certainly. Million and a half? I don't know. I don't even know the census of the Ottoman Empire at the time. Certainly in those periods, many people died as well. One thing the Turkish historians have told me that they feel strongly about is that nobody's talking about the tens, hundreds of thousands of Turks killed in the Balkans, in the Caucasus, and Central Asia at the same time. There was wholesale slaughter of people throughout the Ottoman Empire's lost territories or the then territories of the empire. And these have to be acknowledged by everybody. Everybody should open their archives for very careful investigation. But I don't see anybody opening their archives, though I'm told Turkish archives are open, but my colleagues have told me that it's also very difficult to get permission to go take a look at these archives. So in any case, passing of resolutions here and there in parliaments is not going to resolve this issue at all. It's going to be resolved with direct dialogue between Turks and Armenians themselves.
Let me, we're past our midpoint here, so for people who have been listening, I want to introduce again our guest, and then our previous caller, I think, would like to ask a follow-up, and we can do that. Obviously, the questions that he asked are all very good ones, very important ones, and very complicated ones. Our guest is Biral Yeşilada. He's professor of political science and international studies at Portland State University, where he also chairs contemporary Turkish studies. In addition, he's director of the Northwest American Turkish Research Institute, which is based at Portland State. And we're talking about issues in contemporary Turkish politics. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have about 15 minutes left in the hour. The caller would indeed like to follow up, so we'll give him a chance to do that on our line number two here now. Hello.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Actually, I would like to give somebody else the opportunity to ask a question and just conclude by saying that European public opinion would be much more favorable to its membership if Turkey took the bold step to recognize the Armenian genocide and put the military under total civilian control, as in the rest of the European family. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Well, let me ask you to because the caller did in fact mention as part of the climate here, public opinion in Europe, this issue of the Armenian genocide, and as he mentioned, in fact, yes, the French have just passed a law that would make it illegal to deny, and there are a lot of people who are very concerned about this. The infamous Article 301, this is the article of the Turkish Penal Code that provides someone could be charged for insulting Turkishness. And under this, a number of people, intellectuals and writers, have been charged, one of them indeed being Orhan Pamuk, who just received the Nobel Prize. So it's something that seems to concern, irritate a lot of Europeans. As you said, though, it seems something that is that there may be some small cracks in this in Turkey, but it's something that is not going to change. It's not going to change anytime soon.
I don't think so. I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. The law may disappear. In fact, they're talking about revising 301, which I think is harsher than the previous case of the equal article in the penal code. It's very vague, and it leaves a lot of room open for prosecutors to pursue X, Y, and Z as they wish, and the politicians can do nothing about it unless they change the law. And I, for one, am very much in favor of getting rid of the law. You have to be bold about these things. And, you know, in the United States, we talk about anything and everything. We don't have laws that says you cannot burn the American flag. God help you if you burn the Turkish flag in the Taksim Circle of Istanbul. And Turkey is not unique to that. There are many countries who view that there should be some limits on freedom of whatever. It cannot be absolute. That's anarchy as far as they're concerned. But in terms of public opinion, it's not just this issue. European public opinion on Turkey is very complex. It's not just an Armenian issue or Cyprus issue. It is whether or not Turks are socioculturally European. And you can look at this in the surveys of public opinion in Europe pertaining to candidate countries. Public opinion in the European Union countries has never been in majority support of Turkey's membership. It's gotten close in some countries to 50%, but never, because there is a long historic animosity here. After all, the Ottomans were not that far away in terms of memory. It can always be, people are reminded of the clash between the Ottoman Empire and European empires. And Europeanness, cultural Europeanness of the Turks becomes, you know, like a red herring. When the Europeans are in grave danger of external threat and Turks could help them, they are wonderful Europeans. When that threat disappears, they're no longer Europeans. Well, people in Turkey are not, idiots. They know what's going on, and they question whether or not Europeans really need them. Now, I should also mention one other thing. Increasing number of Turkish citizens are asking, why should they join the European Union? Why can't they stand on their own 2 feet? And I'm not convinced that, let's say, hypothetically, everything is worked out. Everything. And Turkey becomes this perfect example of Western representative liberal democracy with a market economy that's booming, and the Europeans want Turkey to join the EU 20 years from now with open arms, just like they welcome Austria, Sweden, and Finland. Let's say Turkey reaches that level of development. At that point, I'm not sure if the public opinion in Turkey will vote for membership in the EU. And the reason for that is political union, not economic union, political union. Because by the time Turkey is ready to join the European Union, political union in the EU is going to be much deeper. It's inevitable. At that point, Turks will be asked to surrender political sovereignty to Brussels. And that is the $64,000 question. Can they make that choice? I'm not convinced. Hmm.
We have someone else, a caller in here in Champaign County, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Well, thank you for taking the call. This is an interesting discussion, but so far we haven't talked about the Kurds. And I think the Kurdish problem for the Turks is also a problem for a potential Iraq government if it ever succeeds, if the situation ever gets under control, that it would face them too, that and the potential conflict between Iraq and Turkey might arise. What perspective can you provide on the Kurdish problem?
Yeah, it's excellent. That was about to be my next question. So yeah. It's an excellent question.
It is an excellent question. Kurdish problem in Turkey is a very complex one because Kurds are not a monolith, neither are Turks. In many parts of Turkey, you have intermarriages. I recently had a student from Turkey whose mother was Kurdish, father was Turkish, and that's not unusual. Many Kurdish tribal leaders are members of the powerful secular political parties, center-right, center-left. They have served as ministers on government cabinets. They have partially ethnic background of prime minister have been Kurdish. So it's not unusual to see Kurds in the higher levels of governance in Turkey. What we do see is that after the 1980 constitution, there was a very much a design to deny the existence of Kurds in Turkey. That is changing. However, it is very difficult to get people's views changed when you have a terrorist organization which does not represent all of the Kurds, which is a ragtag group of militants from Turkey, Syria, and Iraq carrying out military operations in Turkey, resulting in a lot of deaths. So this is the environment you're dealing with. Now, as with regard to northern Iraq, I haven't had much reaction from the Turkish politicians about a future federal Iraq. But independent Kurdistan, everybody's worried about. Why are they worried about? Well, if independent Kurdistan becomes an entity, will it create threat across the border in Turkey? My view on that is very simple. Turkey is the 800-pound gorilla in the region. It's the hegemon. A little independent Kurdistan can never be a threat. In fact, Kurdistan in northern Iraq is economically very much dependent on Turkey for its lifeline. The number of Turkish companies operating in northern Iraq are numerous. And most people don't realize that many of the construction firms and the companies that are supplying the much-needed concrete for these construction projects in northern Iraq are owned by the economic conglomerate OYAK that's owned by the Turkish military. This is a very important market. Over 300 Turkish companies are operating there. And cross-border trade is booming. Now, the critical issue that sends shockwaves across Turkey is the plight of the Turkoman minority in northern Iraq. We don't talk about them much in the United States, but there is a sizable Turkoman minority that feels very much squeezed between Kurds and Arabs. And Turkey is there sort of guardian. That is an issue. Control of Kirkuk is another one because of oil fields. But in terms of the threat of an independent Kurdistan on Turkey, that's not much of a threat in reality. It is fueled in Turkey as a reality by conspiracy theorists. That's the and that's rampant. There is a growing xenophobia in Turkey that alarms me personally. As far as the rights of the Kurds, absolutely the laws have to be implemented because the reforms in the constitution guarantees them their rights and right to press and education and mother tongue. It's high time for implementation of these laws. And one last point I want to make is that I do not believe that the Copenhagen criteria will be completed unless these rights are thoroughly granted to Kurdish minority in Turkey, just as the European Union is identifying similar problems of minorities in Central and Eastern Europe, and the current members have to carry out those reforms as well.
There are something like 20 million Kurds living in an area that includes parts of Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Syria. I'm sure the concern, and there would be people in Iran, Syria, and Turkey that would be concerned that if there was an independent Kurdistan in northern Iraq, that Kurds in Turkey, Iran, and Syria would seek to affiliate, and then we're not just talking about Kurdistan and northern Iraq. We're talking about something else entirely different, and I'm sure that that also concerns people here in the United States, because it gets the United States government, because it starts to get very complicated, because the Iraqi Kurds are our allies, the Turks are our allies. We want to stay friends with everybody. We're concerned about Turkey's ties, continued ties between Turkey, Iran, and Syria. It's just it seems extraordinarily complicated to me.
Well, it is complicated, and it is complicated. There is no easy solution for that. I think we created a huge mess in Iraq with no end in sight. The implications of what happens in Iraq down the road for regional stability is the thing that really concerns me. And here, I don't see Iraq itself as the threat, rather competition between Iran, Turkey, and others, and how they react to what happens in Iraq. That is the major question from my perspective. Turkey and Iran do not have much in common. One's a theocracy and has declared Turkey as a target for change since 1980. We should not forget that. This is a love-hate relationship. They're competing with each other in the Caucasus, in Central Asia, and now it's going to be Iraq. There could be many scenarios that evolves out of this. Temporarily, there seems to be some mutual cautious relationship of cooperation to bring about stability in the region, but I don't see a long-term mutual interest between Iran and Turkey. And I fear that if Iraq blows up and we have Iranian intervention, that will draw in Turkey into that conflict. That's a very serious threat and a real one. The competition between Iran and Turkey in the region does not disappear in terms of the scenarios I'm looking at until Turkey further integrates with the European Union. Then the balance of power shifts. In the region, we have to remember that Russia's presence is declining. Its capabilities are declining over time, and Iran and Turkey's are growing. And there will be parity between the three in the next couple of decades. Now, with regard to Kurds in southeastern Turkey, I want to mention one other thing. I've been to that region with a watershed project. Basically, there is a huge, massive watershed project in southeastern Turkey that covers the area of land larger than the country of Belgium. It's about halfway done. Once this project is completed, economic well-being of the citizens of the region will improve dramatically. They are going down to the village level to educate people on how to participate through small enterprises in the market economy. Once people get the socioeconomic status of their lives improved, there will be less of targets of militant groups to undo the system. This is a socioeconomic issue. For decades, the Turkish state, through its central economic planning, ignored eastern and southeastern Turkey. You can draw a line right through the middle of the country, north-south line, and find dramatically different two countries.
Let's see if we can squeeze real quick one more caller here in Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Yes.
I'll have to ask you, quick.
I will. Just one little thing.
Sure.
How would your guest perceive the news out of England yesterday of the collapse of the environment in 2050. Thank you.
Go ahead.
It may not relate to what we're discussing, but I thoroughly believe in the scientific studies of global warming. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to see what's going on and how the environment's changing. And I think it's high time. And if I'm not mistaken, Tony Blair came out and endorsed it.
He did, yes. And, yeah. Interestingly enough. Yes.
Yeah, interestingly enough. very much so. We absolutely have to do something about this. And I'm worried that I'm looking at these global projections of on my study, and I see that I see the rapid growth of China. I mean, China has not even started to show us the speed at which it can grow, and the size of its economic expansion, and it's going to be the next giant in polluting the environment.
Well, I think at that point we're going to have to finish up. Thanks to our guest, Biral Yeshilada. He's professor of political science and international studies at Portland State University, where he's also director of the Northwest American Turkish Research Institute. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you very much. It's been an honor.